From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Kristol. He was nicknamed Dan Quayle's brain when he served as the vice president's chief of staff. When Kristol ran his own conservative think tank, Washington Monthly called him the GOP's master strategist. Now Kristol edits and publishes the new conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard. Also today, what are the best seats to get when you're flying, and how can you get them? We talk with Ed Perkins, editor of Consumer Reports' new travel guide. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Lou Reed's new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Kristol, is the editor and publisher of the new conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard. He now spends his time commenting on conservative politics in his magazine and on television forums like This Week with David Brinkley. But he's also been a major player in politics. During the Reagan administration, Kristol was chief of staff for then-Secretary of Education William Bennett. Kristol went on to become chief of staff for Vice President Dan Quayle. After Bill Clinton moved into the White House, Kristol influenced the direction of the Republican Party through his small think tank called Project for the Republican Future. In 1994, the Washington Monthly called Kristol the GOP's master strategist. He's the son of Irving Kristol, one of the fathers of neoconservatism. I asked Bill Kristol what role he'd like his new magazine to play in the American political debate and in the Republican Party.
I think our magazine can play a role, and has in the 6 months it's existed, in forcing conservatives to face some tough questions and stimulating debate among conservatives and moderates. We don't want to simply be a magazine that takes the same old pot shots at liberals that lots of conservatives have been taking for years, and I've been taking for years, and I happen to believe in a lot of those pot shots. But there are enough other conservative organs, you know, in truth, that are doing that pretty effectively. Conservatism is on the verge, potentially, of being the governing ideology, if you will, of the United States. The Republican Party is on the verge of being the majority party in the country. It's tougher to govern than to be in opposition, and it requires more thoughtfulness about public policy, about politics, about culture. And I hope our magazine can be a place, and is a place, where intelligent people debate what the content and the style of a new governing conservatism should be.
Do you have any colleagues who see you as defecting to the enemy side, the press?
Sure, but I don't know that I've really, I don't know that I'm quite what I consider myself. I'm the editor and publisher. People who are at the magazine are genuine reporters. I wouldn't quite claim to be that. It has been hard to explain to some of my former allies that this is a magazine we're running, not a propaganda sheet and not a political instrument. I publish things I don't entirely agree with. People, some of my political friends assume that, you know, I somehow am personally writing all 40 pages of editorial copy in the magazine. And that's been a little bit of an educational process, I think, for some of our friends who read an article that characterizes something they've said in some way, and they call me up all offended. And I say, look, it's a magazine. You know, there's a reporter reporting on something or giving his opinion about something, and I thought it was a legitimate opinion and part of the debate. This magazine does expose the divisions among conservatives. I think conservatism is mature enough and healthy enough now that kind of airing of disputes and of arguments is healthy rather than the opposite, but not all conservatives agree with me on that.
Well, I think a lot of people see infighting or arguing about issues within a party as being a Democratic thing, not a Republican thing.
Well, I guess that's true, but you know, the fact is some of the most bitter infighting or most vigorous argument, if you want to put a nicer spin on it, happens in political parties when they're successful, not when they're failing. You know, the Democrat, nothing, the height of the Roosevelt coalition in the 30s and the 40s was when some of the bitterest arguments took place within the Democratic Party, some of the most fundamental debates about the shape of liberalism in the United States. And typically a party starts to decline when its thinking becomes ossified, when it's not open to fresh ideas. And I think, I hope our magazine prevents that from happening for conservatism in the United States.
Do you think the Republican Party can unify around Bob Dole?
Yeah, I think the Republican Party will be reasonably united behind Dole. Every 4 years, one party or the other, whichever one's out of power, has bitter primaries, and people worry that how can they possibly unite? Clinton was subject to very bitter attacks in 92, obviously. Reagan Bush in 1980 was a very bitter primary fight. Dole's acceptable to all wings of the party. I think the party will be united. Whether it will be energized, whether Bob Dole will be, at the end of the day, a compelling presidential candidate is another question, and it's one that worries a lot of Republicans.
Is he compelling to you?
I like and respect Bob Dole, but if you think the job of a presidential candidate is really to articulate an agenda for the future, if you think we're at a turning point in American politics and there really is an opportunity, especially on the conservative side, to lay out a sense of where we're going and to be somewhat bold in advancing arguments about how we can get there, that's not Bob Dole. Now, you know, that may be fine. Bob Dole is a responsible and serious man. I think he'd be a decent president. And perhaps the American people need that kind of more modest, reassuring leadership at this point. They turn out not to be in the market for bold and adventuresome conservative leadership. So over the long run, the Republican and conservative realignment might be able to continue under the somewhat reassuring, if unexciting, leadership of Bob Dole.
It's hard to find a lot of people who are excited about Bob Dole as a presidential candidate. How do you think the Republicans ended up with Dole when it's so hard to find people who are wildly enthusiastic about him?
Well, Dole's a weak candidate who won because many strong candidates chose not to run. Cheney, Bennett, Kemp, Quayle, Colin Powell, all of them would have been, I think, formidable candidates in the Republican primary field. None of them chose to run. Pete Wilson and Phil Gramm were probably the two most impressive candidates, at least by conventional standards, who did run. You know, governor of the nation's largest state, senator from the nation's second largest state, both impressive political characters. And for whatever reason, each ran campaigns that collapsed, and neither made it to the New Hampshire primary. If you had told Bob Dole 6 months ago, after New Hampshire, you'll be facing two main candidates, both of whom were journalists, Steve Forbes and Pat Buchanan, neither of whom has ever been elected to anything, he would have said, wow, that's a pretty good matchup for me. I'll take it. And he did, and of course he beat them.
Bill Kristol is my guest, and he's now the editor and publisher of the conservative magazine The Weekly Standard. You've spent a lot of time over the past few months in your magazine analyzing Patrick Buchanan's campaign and analyzing how much of a force he is in the Republican Party, what his chances are and everything. Now it looks like he really doesn't have a chance of actually getting the nomination. How much power do you think he still has within the party? How much power do you think he'll have to affect what the Republican platform will be or to affect the agenda during the convention?
Well, Pat Buchanan, now that he can't be the nominee, and says, well, I'm going to write the platform. I think Bob Dole probably should stand up and say, look, I'm going to write the platform. I'm the one who got the huge bulk of votes in the primaries. You, Pat Buchanan, are going to the convention with something like 5-10% of the delegates. I want your support. I want the support of those who voted for you, but I'm not letting you write the platform. And indeed, Buchanan's views have been repudiated by a majority of Republicans on lots of issues. It's true he seems to have hit a nerve on the issue of economic anxiety. We have a piece in the next issue of the Weekly Standard trying to lay out some sensible reforms in the way corporations are governed that would address some of what I think are people's legitimate concerns, that the executives can give themselves big bonuses and somehow aren't really accountable to the shareholders, that sort of thing. So Buchanan deserves a little credit for hitting a chord there. But I think Bob Dole should be reasonably tough with Pat Buchanan. Doesn't have to go around attacking him gratuitously, but he should not let the Republican Party become a Buchananite party. The majority of Republicans don't want that.
In looking at the Republican Revolution, you recently wrote, it overpromised. What do you mean?
Well, Republicans won a huge electoral victory in November 94 and were enthusiastic to begin doing good for the country. And I don't mean that sarcastically. I think the Republicans who came to the Hill in January of 95 were genuinely wanted to get to work changing public policies in this country. I think at the end of the day, though, you can't really change fundamental public policies in the United States without having the presidency as well as Congress. You can make some changes when you have Congress, but it takes two elections to change policies fundamentally in this country, a congressional election like 1994 and then a presidential election. Republicans tried to do too much from the Hill. They had narrow majorities in both houses. They tried to bring about big changes. And ultimately, when Clinton sort of regained his footing and stood up to the Republicans, it turned out the presidency is a more powerful institution than Newt Gingrich and some other Republicans thought it was. I still think over the long run, the country's going to go in the direction that the 1994 elections indicated. But I think in retrospect, they would have been better off, and I argued this at the time, they would have been better off taking 1995 and 1996 and trying to make some modest changes in direction in public policy to lay the groundwork for longer-term changes over the next several years instead of trying to do everything at once.
What do you think the Republicans should stress in the presidential campaign?
Well, I think in this presidential campaign, if it's Dole Clinton, Clinton has a pretty good chance in the sense that he is younger, more energetic, will presumably do better in the debates and the like. If it's the Republican Party as a whole versus the Democratic Party as a whole, I think then Dole has a good chance. The Republican Party has a good chance. The American people tend to agree more with the Republican Party on the core issues of size and scope of government. They trust the Republicans more in foreign policy, which is awfully important in a presidential campaign, or I think could become important once again in this presidential campaign. I think the team of leading Republicans is more impressive now than the team of leading Democrats, whether it's Dick Cheney and Colin Powell and Dick Lugar in foreign policy, or governors like Engler of Michigan and Thompson of Wisconsin. So I think Dole's best bet is to try to make it a referendum on sort of the overall Republican Party's agenda against the Democratic Party's agenda.
I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Bill Kristol. He's now the editor and publisher of the conservative magazine The Weekly Standard. We'll be right back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bill Kristol. He's the former chief of staff for Dan Quayle and William Bennett and now edits The Weekly Standard, a new conservative magazine. The Christian Coalition has been very influential within the Republican Party. It was founded by Pat Robertson, who many people have cited for coded anti-Semitic references. You're Jewish, and I wonder how you feel about the power of the Christian Coalition within your party.
Well, I think the power of religious conservatives in the party and in the country is simply a fact. There are lots of religious Americans. Most of them are Christians. They have every right to be involved in politics. And I think they are right to think that lots of public policies in the last 30, 40 years have been unfriendly to their involvement and to their interests. And the country would be better off with policies like school choice, which would make it easier for parents of all sorts, including religious parents, to select the schools their kids go to. For example. So I am generally a fan of religious conservatives and a defender of religious conservatives. That's not to say that there aren't times when particular religious conservatives, including Pat Robertson, go over what I would regard as the appropriate line in terms of division of religion from politics or,
give me an example.
Or church from state. Well, I don't think it's appropriate, for example, to say, as Robertson said back, I think, in 86, 87, when he was running for president, that in effect, voting for him was a godly vote, you know, that somehow you are a better human being if you have a more religious, more pious, more devout human being, if you have one set of political views or support one candidate rather than another. And I think to the credit of the Christian right, they have matured an awful lot in the last 10, 20 years, and there have been struggling. People like Ralph Reed have done this pretty explicitly, have been struggling to think through for themselves. The right way to approach politics. They want to be involved in politics. They obviously want a political system that is friendly to their values and to their efforts to bring up their kids in the way they would like. But they also know that it's inappropriate to use the political system for sectarian religious ends. And this isn't such an easy, cut-and-dried set of issues as sometimes liberals or others pretend. And I think there's some interesting intellectual debates and struggles going on among religious conservatives. And actually, some of them have been featured in the pages of our magazine.
Bill Kristol is my guest, and he's now editing The Weekly Standard, a new conservative magazine. You were chief of staff for Bill Bennett when he was Secretary of Education under President Reagan, and then chief of staff for Dan Quayle when he was vice president. Did you ever want to hold office yourself?
Yeah, if only they elected people to be chief of staff. When I became Quayle's chief of staff, a friend wrote a letter joking that I was the only person he knew who now seemed to be on course to being a professional chief of staff, which is limited job opportunities there. I think anyone who's been a staff person probably at times thinks, gee, it would be great to be the principal, as they say in Washington. You know, either your staff or your principal. And it would be fun to be the number one guy and have the staff do all the work for you instead of being the top staff guy and worrying about whether the staff was doing all the work adequately for your boss. But, you know, people who run for office go through a lot that I'm not sure I'd want to go through. And I very much enjoyed being Bill Bennett's chief of staff and very much enjoyed being Dan Quayle's chief of staff. And have no particular ambition to run for office myself.
You know, it's interesting. Bill Bennett is, you know, an intellectual. Dan Quayle had the reputation, whether it was just or not, of being not the intellectual, of being even not that bright. Were they very different to work for? Was your job as chief of staff terribly different with each of them?
Yeah, it was different. I mean, less because they're so different. In some ways, they were surprisingly similar. They're both very easy and nice people to work for one thing. And they're both bright. Obviously, they have different backgrounds. Bill Bennett's a PhD in philosophy. Dan Quayle isn't. And Bennett was education secretary, which gave him a kind of bully pulpit to discuss ideas and education and intellectual matters. When you're vice president of the United States, you have a much broader range of things you have to discuss and much less focus on sort of the intellectual world. But they were both they're both awfully good people to work for. And there really are two kinds of people in Washington, you know, those who are good to work for and those who aren't. And some of the people who have good reputations in Washington are sort of well known to be monsters to their own staff and vice versa. And I was lucky really to work for both of them, and they really are friends now.
You were, when you were chief of staff for Dan Quayle, when he was vice president, you were nicknamed Quayle's brain, the intellectual behind Quayle's positions and strategies, the person who got Quayle to quote Plato in the Talmud. How did it feel to be nicknamed Quayle's brain, to have that reputation as the intellectual behind the politician who is not considered to be that bright?
Yeah, I think the number of times Dan Quayle quoted Plato or the Talmud could be counted on one hand, and then some, not even on all the fingers. It was just, no, I mean, this became sort of a popular, I don't know, people liked that formulation. It was a way of obviously of subtly, not so subtly, denigrating Dan Quayle and sort of pretending to boost me, but probably at the end of the day trying to denigrate me too. It wasn't really fair. I mean, the truth about Dan Quayle is that he had made up his own mind on everything. He had studied up on lots of issues when he was a senator. I hope I helped him as chief of staff. I think we had a very good staff in general. But it's just not the case that I, you know, said we should do ABC and that Dan Quayle went out and did ABC. If anything, I would say of the different staffs I've now observed pretty close up in 10 years in Washington, we had one of the most collegial staffs in which he participated. You know, genuine arguments about, well, should we take on legal reform as an issue and how should we do it and how can we actually make a difference? And when he was a full participant in those discussions, and ultimately he made the decisions. So, you know, but you can't control what people say about you. And my only regret, really, I very much enjoyed the 4 years. Obviously, I regret that Bush lost re-election, but I console myself with the fact that I think I warned that he would lose and that I and some of my colleagues on Quayle's staff were, if our advice had been taken, we might have been, I think we might have avoided that fate. I mean, I think we saw that Bush was in deep trouble a lot earlier than most of President Bush's own advisors. My one regret is that I never really did do much good, I don't think, in helping Dan Quayle dig out from the hole that had been dug for him and for which he was partly responsible from the 88 campaign. First impressions, you know, Terry, are so powerful, I think, in this age of mass media especially. And the first impression he made was bad on the American people, partly his fault, I mean, granted, but partly not his fault, partly the fault of, you know, the Bush advisors who threw him into this thing without any preparation, and partly the fault of the press, which was unfair. And it just, we kept trying to sort of, you know, to get him out from the hole that he began in, and it's just as when we thought we might have a chance, you know, he would make some gaffe, and of course all politicians make gaffes, but somehow when he made it, it was devastating, and he just, you know, would fall right back down the hill again.
You've opposed the, quote, cultural elite. And hey, weren't you part of it?
Sure. Yeah. That's how I knew enough to oppose it.
Okay.
You know? I know it so well.
Let me run through your cultural elite credentials. Your father is Irving Kristol, who was a central part of post-World War II's circle of New York intellectuals. Your father edited magazines of political thought. I believe he had a column in the Wall Street Journal. You went to an elite private high school, then went to Harvard, then taught at Harvard. And if that's not cultural elite, you know, what would be?
No, it is. It is. And as I say, I know the cultural elite well, and I think I know their flaws. I also know some of their strengths. And I taught at Harvard, and I tried to help, you know, build up the Kennedy School where I taught at Harvard. I don't think we should go out and, you know, I'm not with Pat Buchanan. I'm not leading peasants with pitchforks to tear down our great educational institutions or to destroy magazines. But I do think, I mean, you know, I'm not being simply facetious. It is probably true that I, having grown up with men in these institutions and close to them, one also sees their flaws, and I think those flaws are pretty real.
I think it's sometimes easy to interpret the phrase cultural elite as a code word for an anti-intellectualism. And as an intellectual yourself, I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, I mean, if it were interpreted that way, I would reject that interpretation. And I think at least Dan Quayle and Bill Bennett, for whom I work, tried to be pretty careful not to portray it that way. On the other hand, intellectuals do deserve lots of criticism. And intellectuals, I would say the opposite side of this is that intellectuals, whenever they're subject to criticism, immediately say, oh, that's just anti-intellectualism. So it, you know, it cuts both ways. I think you'd have to judge it by the substance of the argument and the way in which it came up with Dan Quayle. Let's not forget, he didn't just suddenly decide, I'm going to give a speech attacking the cultural elite. He gave actually a very long and well-reasoned, pretty careful speech about the causes of the L.A. riots and what could be done about them. And as part of that speech, he talked about the damage done by the breakup of the family in the inner cities, and about illegitimacy, and that's where he mentioned Murphy Brown famously. Now, that was my fault as much as anything. I remember on the plane out to San Francisco where he was giving that speech, he said, you know, maybe we should just take out, the vice president said, maybe we should just take out that reference to Murphy Brown, you know, it'd be kind of a distraction. It's a pretty serious speech. It goes through all this data. We don't want to get into some argument about TV and pop culture. And I cheerfully said, oh, you might as well leave it in. No one will notice it. You know, another brilliant piece of political advice from me. But it was the reaction to that speech which led to the subsequent Quayle speech where he said, large parts of our cultural elite just don't get it. They think that to raise the issue of illegitimacy is somehow, to be a Neanderthal or to be hostile to the interests of the poor. So that was really the concrete circumstances of that speech. And I do think Quayle's been vindicated to a large degree by subsequent scholarship and really by the whole development of the political debate, by things Bill Clinton has said over the last couple of years on the issue of the black family in particular, but the American family more generally, and the danger of having, 30% of American kids now born out of wedlock.
Bill Kristol is the editor and publisher of the new conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Bill Kristol and find out what it was like to grow up the son of a prominent neoconservative father, Irving Kristol. Also, some advice on getting the best seat when you're flying, and Ken Tucker reviews Lou Reed's new CD.
Wind blows snow outside my window. Crowd below runs wild in the streets. Two rented brothers race down two separate alleys, heading for the finish line. Down in the train yard, out by the stockyard, butchers with aprons hack meat in the snow. Blood has the brothers pulsing with envy, heading for the finish line. Two rented brothers' faces keep changing, like these feelings that I have for you. Nothing's forever, not even 5 minutes. when you're heading for the finish line. Down by the depot, out by the meat rack, ah, down by the tunnels surrounding the jails. Prisoners are marching squares and in circles. They're heading for the finish line.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Bill Kristol, editor and publisher of the new conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard. Kristol served as Vice President Dan Quayle's chief of staff, and during the Reagan administration was chief of staff for then-Secretary of Education William Bennett. Kristol also ran his own Republican think tank and has been considered a leading conservative strategist. He's the son of one of the originators of neoconservatism. Your father, Irvin Kristol, had been a liberal then. I believe it was in the 60s that he became a neoconservative. And, you know, there's that old expression that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged. And your father once said a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. What are your memories of your father's transformation? Where were you politically at the time?
Well, if truth be told, my father was never as liberal as people now think, and I'd say he was always a skeptic, and it was certainly an anti-communist liberal for one thing, and a liberal who was skeptical about excessive faith in liberalism, in progress, and in all the kind of liberal totems of the 50s and 60s. So he didn't have really a radical transformation. Of course, in the 60s, the culture as a whole, the political system as a whole, underwent a pretty radical transformation, and he opposed the new left, and that made him and others a neoconservative. I mean, I was always skeptical and really hostile, I guess you'd say, to the new left and to the counterculture. Most of my friends, most of my classmates were enthusiastic about the 60s, both at the high school I went to in New York City and then at Harvard. In that respect, I always sided with my parents against my generation, I guess. And I guess I thought my parents had better arguments than my peers did. I think I was right in retrospect. I mean, in a way, I do think there it was easy to be very skeptical of these claims that this is such a wonderful generation and it was new breakthroughs in understanding and by the youth culture of the 60s. Because if you were close to it, you could see that really wasn't the case.
On campuses in the early 70s when you were in college, I think there were many public debates about tactics and policy for the student movement and so on. And there'd be microphones in the middle of large forums and people would go up to the microphone and say really heated things. Did you ever do that? Did you ever take the mic at one of these like huge student rallies and argue?
Yeah, a little bit. Mostly just to cause trouble and be provocative since those are not real occasions to persuade people, especially since most of the people had shown up already committed to a point of view very different from one's own point of view. I was never really a student activist, though, and I wasn't involved in the conservative activist groups like Young Americans for Freedom that were on campus at that time. I really was, in that respect, more of a controversialist. I mean, I enjoyed reading and arguing and writing stuff, but I was never much of a, stand up in front of a crowd of students and lead them to charge the barricades.
But when you did take the mic, what would you say? What points would you argue?
I would probably just be sarcastic and be a smart aleck and try to point out that all these great, that there was so much self-praise and self-congratulation among students and young people then. I think that's what most turned me off about the new left, probably. Less any rigorous intellectual analysis of their arguments and more the sense that these were a bunch of people who were my classmates. I knew them well. Some of them were bright, some not so bright, some decent, some not so decent, but they hadn't reinvented the world. They didn't have any great discoveries that people of earlier ages didn't know. And the notion that they suddenly understood how universities should be organized or how the economy should be run or how foreign policy should be conducted just struck me as a kind of generational egotism. And it was off-putting. It was personally off-putting. There was a lot of arrogance there. And I do think in that respect, being conservative was fun and in a way useful because it taught one to be skeptical about all these great claims that suddenly we know how to do everything. And I mean, I think conservatism needs some of that skepticism today now that it's more in the ascendancy. And not to sound like some, you know, crotchety middle-aged guy, but I do think conservatives of my generation, it was good for us to go through being in the minority and having to argue unpopular positions. And there's a way in which some of the conservative, younger conservatives who came up in the 80s, when it became fashionable by the Reagan administration to be conservative, I think they suffered a little intellectually and maybe even in terms of their character, because they had it easy in a sense. You know, the people around them were conservative. They were rewarded for being conservative. And there's a way in which it's good for you to be in the minority for at least some time in your life.
I've been seeing you lately on the Brinkley Show a fair amount.
Mm-hmm.
How do you like doing the show?
Oh, I like it. They're very nice people. David Brinkley's a, you know, wonderful man, and the rest of the group is pleasant, and, you know, I hope I say something interesting in the 9 or 12 or 15 minutes that one has. TV is a funny medium, you know, and it's always hard to know. And you can over-prepare for that round table and try to think of a couple of interesting things to say, and then it comes off stilted and artificial. The one thing I've learned is that you really do have to make yourself relax and pretend there's not a camera, and you often say the more interesting things and say it more naturally if you just, you know, go with the discussion and make the comments that you've thought about but that occur to you. I think it's a big mistake to go on TV with these little sound bites in your mind. You see people do this some of the time,
mm-hmm.
and sort of force them out. And I think it looks funny. And at the end of the day, that's not why people are watching this. They do want to see, obviously, an informed discussion. They want you to have thought about the issues ahead of time. But they want to see an honest and real discussion among some people.
So what's the difference between the type of feedback you get from your magazine, The Weekly Standard, and the feedback you get when you've been on the journalist roundtable on the Brinkley Show at the end of the show?
Well, TV is an awfully powerful medium, and that's what one, if you start being on TV a little bit, you know, no, you have to be struck by the number of people who just recognize you and the odd way in which people are sort of pleased to meet you because they've seen you on TV. There's something a little, I don't mean to, I'm not being scornful of people who do that. I'm that way. We're all that way with celebrities of one sort or another, actors and actresses, sports heroes. And of course, you know, people like me on Brinkley Roundtable are a million cuts below that. But there is something odd about the way in which when people have seen you on TV, they sort of look at you in a whole new way, as opposed to simply being someone whom they might have read about in a newspaper or whose articles they might have read. I still think, though, that print journalism is key. Print drives TV, and for that matter, radio, if I can say so. You know, the real arguments tend to be laid out in magazines and in newspapers, and then TV picks up those arguments and popularizes them and dramatizes them and makes them obviously accessible to millions and millions of people. So TV is powerful and important, but I think it's ultimately derivative of print. And for all the talk about the death of print and books and magazines and newspapers are going, you know, going to go the way of the dinosaur, I don't really buy that. I'm struck from my years in politics and now on the other side of the aisle how key you know, arguments in print really are. You know, if you look at the big changes in public policy, you can trace a lot of them back to key articles and key books and key debates that were engaged in magazines and in newspapers.
Well, Bill Kristol, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
Bill Kristol is the editor and publisher of the new conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard. Coming up, a review of Lou Reed's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Set the Twilight Reeling is Lou Reed's first collection of new songs since 1992's Magic and Loss, an album-length meditation on death. Set the Twilight Reeling finds the founding member of the Velvet Underground in a considerably more upbeat mood, but as rock critic Ken Tucker says, he's still Lou Reed.
Sky, all purple, blue, and orange, as some pigeons flying by. The traffic on Canal Street so noisy, it's a shock. And someone shooting fireworks or a gun on the next block. And I wanna hokey pokey with you.
I never thought I'd hear myself describing a Lou Reed song as cute, but that's the best word for Hooky Wookie, Reed's new song about hanky panky. If you read the lyrics in the gossip pages, old Uncle Lou is having a dandy time with musician Laurie Anderson, whom he's now dating and writing love songs to. She also pops up on background vocals here. The best thing about Set the Twilight Reeling is that while his mood may have lightened, his music has only gotten tighter and catchier.
I was a young man, no bigger than this. A chocolate egg cream was not to be missed. Some you bet chocolate syrup, seltzer water mixed with milk. Stir it up into a heady flow, tasted just like syrup. You scream, I steam, we all want egg cream.
There's a terrific sound to this record. Reed plays all the lead guitar parts, and in tone they recall the buzzing drone that he perfected way back in his days with the Velvet Underground, but with a new precision and clarity. That's also true of the lyrics. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything on Set the Twilight Reeling that matches the best of the Velvets, but in new, dreamy songs like Trade In, The Proposition, and the title song, Reed reveals a different side of himself, and the result is a tender earnestness unprecedented in his music.
Take me for what I am, a star newly emerging. Long simmering, explode, inside the self is reeling. In the pocket of the heart, in the rushing of the blood, in the muscle of my sex, in the mindful, mindless love. I accept the newfound man, and I set the twilight reeling.
I accept the newfound man, says Lou Reed on that song. He's talking about himself, and on the simplest level, this is the sound of a man who's dizzily optimistic in love. When a writer for Interview Magazine asked him whether the woman of a thousand faces, referred to in the song Trade-In, was Laurie Anderson, he said, yeah, and that's underestimating it. From most other singer-songwriters, the guileless vulnerability displayed throughout this album might seem treacly and sentimental. But Lou Reed understands very shrewdly that, coming from Lou Reed, whose image has always been that of a profound cynic, such sentiments sound like the revelations of a born-again romantic.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly.
Met a new me at 8 a.m. The other one got lost. This is not a trade-in, although I wouldn't believe the cost. I woke up crying as we said goodbye. Me and my old self each day vanished more and more as I became someone else. He actually was murdered. I'd taken him apart. But when I put him back together, I couldn't find his heart. It was resting underneath a chair in a bed of bright tin foil. If I pulled back the flaps, I could still see it beat. I could still hear his voice on call as I said, I wanna trade in a 14th chance at this life. I met a woman with a thousand faces, and I want to make her my wife. I could have been so mistaken. I could have think that it was true. A child that is raised by an idiot and that idiot then becomes you. How could I believe in a movie? How could I believe in a book? But most of all...
Coming up, finding the most comfortable seats on airplanes. This is Fresh Air. One of the reasons so many travelers dread long plane flights is the discomfort, hours of feeling cramped while you're strapped to a chair with pitifully little legroom. But some seats are better than others. Ed Perkins is the co-editor of Consumer Reports' new book, The 1996 Best Travel Deals. He also edits the Consumer Reports travel letter. They rate the relative comfort of seats on different airlines and different planes. I asked him what standards they use.
We use a formula based on a combination of three factors. One of the formula we've developed, the width of the seat, the amount of legroom you have, and the way the seats are arranged in the cabin, which has an impact on how many people are in or next to somebody in one of those middle seats that everybody hates.
Now, this varies from airline to airline?
It varies from airline to airline. Some of the factors vary from airline to airline. Others just vary from airplane to airplane. For example, let's take the Boeing 737, which is the most popular airplane flying around these days. All of the major airlines have the same seating combination, which is six abreast in the back end, three seats on each side. And the width of the cabin determines the width of the seat. So that the only variable there is the amount of legroom you get. Now, that is purely an airline choice. These seats are mounted on tracks so that you can readjust the spacing, fore and aft spacing, in half-inch increments. In that particular airplane, the only choice the airline has really is how much legroom do we want to give. Now, let's take another airplane, the MD-11. Now, in that one, in coach class, the airlines have their choice of two configurations. Some airlines have 9 seats in each row, others have 10. This is a wide body. And that makes a lot of difference in the seat width. So in that particular airplane, while the airline has a management decision, both the seat width and the legroom. So these are the variables that the airline can decide what to do on each individual plane. And, yes, it does vary airline by airline.
So which are the best airlines and which are the best planes for seating comfort?
The best airline is easy. It's a small airline that flies from a hub in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's called Midwest Express. And it's the only domestic airline that essentially gives you first-class seating at coach prices. It flies DC-9s and MD-80s, which are normally in coach class, 5 across seating, 3 on one side of the aisle and 2 on the other. In Midwest Express, there are just 2 seats on each side of the aisle. There are no middle seats. They give you decent legroom. It's very much like flying first class on other airlines, MD-80s and DC-9s. But they still charge the same competitive coach prices. So that's why Consumer Reports has rated Midwest Express number 1, and Midwest Express also comes out number 1 in just about everybody else's survey in which it's included. Once you get beyond that, the differences airline to airline aren't as great because Midwest Express is so far ahead of who's in second place. Rating-wise, the next one down the list is probably Kiwi, a small, low-fare airline that operates in the East. And they're... main claim to fame in terms of comfort is extra legroom. They've got 2 to 3 inches more legroom than you get on most of the big airlines. Another airline that gives extra legroom is Frontier, another small airline that's hubs in Denver. Of the bigger airlines, Alaska generally does better than most of its competitors, as does TWA, by about an inch or so in terms of legroom.
What about different airplanes? Which airplanes are the most comfortable?
Part of that, of course, depends on the airline, but at any given amount of legroom, the Boeing 767 and the new Boeing 777, which is flying just on United right now, look to be far ahead of their competitors in terms of seat comfort.
Now, there's a couple of tricks, aren't there, in terms of asking for certain seats within a plane, because those seats have a little more room, like sometimes the seats by the emergency exit have a little more room?
Yes, the emergency exit rows on most airplanes have extra legroom. In the case of a wide body, sometimes a lot, in that the emergency exits are also doors, so that you might have a space there of 5 or 6 feet between the first row in right behind the door and then the row that's in front of the door. So, in terms of legroom, those seats are very good, but there are some other offsetting disadvantages to them in that there are also areas where people tend to congregate when they're waiting to get into the lavatory, and also areas where you sometimes don't see the movie screen very well from there. So there are those trade-offs.
Any other seats that have a little bit more legroom than the other seats?
Well, usually the front seats in any cabin have a little bit more legroom, and of course the advantage there is that the people in front can't lean their seat back right in your lap either.
Right.
Because there's nobody there, because it isn't really legroom, but it amounts to the same thing. And then there's some other rows that you have to watch out for.
Yeah.
Quite often, the last row of seats in front of an emergency exit, the seat back won't go back at all.
Oh.
Because they don't want to in any way block the use of the exit, so they don't allow those seats to recline. But, of course, the problem with all of this is that there are only a handful of these extra room seats typically available on any plane, and there are usually far more people asking for them than the airline can accommodate.
Do you think air travel has gotten any more or less comfortable over the years?
Oh, over the years, it's the coach product, the mass market product, has become a lot less comfortable.
Less comfortable.
I mean, when I started flying, the seats were wider than coach. There's a lot of legroom, a lot of personal attention, but that's because it was it was an elite product designed for an elite market, and as part of this democratization, why we've obviously had to go through procedures to cut the costs. So that in order to, essentially the price we pay for these low fares is very crowded airplanes and much, much reduced levels of service compared with what we had 40 years ago.
Complete this sentence for me. If I could change the airlines and improve airline travel, I would...
What I would like to see the big airlines do is what a few smaller airlines have done, which is offer a premium economy option that would give you more legroom, a wider seat, for a premium of, say, 30 to 40% over the cheapest advertised fare. They could do that. In my calculations, they'd make profit doing that. Because I think it's unrealistic to say, I would love to have wider seats and more legroom, but without accepting the concomitants of that, which is that if you put fewer seats in the plane, you're going to have to charge more per seat. And I don't object to paying more for a better product. What I do object to is the airline's pricing system right now, where I can buy a cheap seat to New York round trip when there's an airfare sale going on for $400. If I want a comfortable seat, it's $2,000. I think that's a ridiculous difference, and I would like to see that the airlines react to that marketplace.
So you'd suggest just having, like, an extra section there in which the seats had a little bit more legroom?
More legroom, wider seats, overall better service, and charge a moderate, a reasonable premium for that.
Sounds like a good suggestion.
Yeah, because, I mean, the bottom line is there's still a vast majority of the people in this country, obviously, will put up with very narrow seats and almost no legroom in order to save a buck. Fine. I don't think, I mean, that's the marketplace, and I don't presume to impose my values on it. But what I'm saying is that for those of us who want something a little better at a moderate price, I'd like to see the market, like to see the airlines cater to our market as well.
Ed Perkins co-edited the 1996 edition of the Consumer Reports book, Best Travel Deals. Today is the first day of spring, so we'll end the show with a spring song by the wonderful Frank Lesser. It's gloomier than your spring lyric about buds and sunshine, but the composition is sublime. This is Jerry Southern. Jerry Southern singing Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Roberta Shurrock, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Osler's Web, The Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Epidemic by Hillary Johnson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as Hollywood prepares for the Academy Awards, we talk with film critics Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel about their all-time favorite films, this year's nominees, and more. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.